Brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry, this is the Chemistry World Podcast.
Hello, welcome to the April 2009 edition of the Chemistry World Podcast with James Mitchell-Crowe, Nina Notman, Phil Broadwith and Bibiana Campasejo. In this month's show, building better batteries, how researchers have come up with a way to top up flat cells in just a fraction of the time it usually takes.
These batteries could be up to 100 times faster to charge and discharge, so you could potentially be charging up your laptop in a couple of minutes rather than having to wait for a couple of hours. And ultimately, the hope is that lithium batteries could be powering electric cars, and then you could charge up the battery as quick as it would be to fill up your car with petrol at the moment.
More from James on that story in just a moment. Also, where there's muck, there's brass. Or perhaps that should be biofuels, because scientists have come up with a way to turn household rubbish into environmentally friendly fuel.
We mitigate 98% of the greenhouse gas emissions when we compare that ethanol to petrol. So typically when you drive your car, a petrol car, on average you will emit around 160 grams of carbon dioxide for every kilometre that you travel. Of course, here we're less than five.
Impressive numbers indeed. That's Jeremy Tomkinson. He'll be joining us in just a moment to explain how that new system works. And also on the way, how researchers are giving machines a uniquely human sense of smell.
It's a bioelectronic nose, so it's taking real human smell receptors and building them into a device using a conducting polymer nanotube laid over some electrodes to make the sensor. The binding event at the receptor site causes a change in the charge distribution on the nanotube, which gives an electrical signal through the rest of the device.
Hello, I'm Chris Smith, and this is Chemistry World.
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.
The original Human Genome Project cost more than £1 billion and took more than 10 years to complete. But now industry is coming up with increasingly fast and ingenious new ways to decode the sequence of genetic letters in a DNA strand, including a new approach, Phil, that means that you don't even have to amplify or copy the genetic material first. But how does it work?
Well, Chris, this is some work that's come out of Hagen Bailey's group in Oxford. They've got a whole spin-out company doing it. It's a technique for reading DNA base by base. As you said, you don't need to amplify the DNA. You don't need to tag it with fluorescent markers, which is what they do at the moment.
So what's the apparatus? How does it actually work, this?
Well, the system's based on a protein nanopore, which is a protein which makes a hole in a lipid membrane. They've put a chemical modifier into that, an adapter is what they call it, and that can bind DNA bases in a temporary manner. So you've got that in a membrane, and the whole thing's surrounded by a salt solution, and you put a voltage across the whole thing, and you can measure the current of the salt ions going through the pore. Then they've got an enzyme floating around in the top of the solution that's chopping up DNA. So as the DNA gets chopped up, each base can find its way into the pore and bind temporarily, which blocks the current, and different bases block the current to a different extent. So that allows you to directly read off in a digital way exactly which base is binding in the pore. And eventually, to make a sequencing technology, what they want to do is attach the protein that chops the DNA up onto the nanopore, which, so as soon as a base is chopped off, it drops into the nanopore, binds, you get a reading of the sequence, and then it carries on through the pore.
Why do scientists think this is better than, say, an amplification method? What are the advantages of doing it this way?
Well, it's much cheaper for a start. For standard techniques at the moment, it takes a lot of sample preparation. You need to chemically modify the DNA. You need to amplify it, which can lead to sequence changes. And also you need very expensive detection equipment. You need very high-resolution cameras to detect the fluorescence. This, you don't need any of that. You just take a straight digital reading off the sequence.
How do they stop themselves ending up with a sort of DNA-based traffic jam upstream of this pore? So how do you get the enzyme so it chops off a base and then that base gets read? You don't end up with them all floating around in solution, getting each other's way.
At the moment, all of the different bits are floating around in the solution above the pore. So we've got no way of reading what the sequence is. But what they want to do is attach the two elements together so that so that the bases drop into the pore as soon as they're chopped off the strand. And the binding is much quicker than the enzyme chopping the bases, so there's no possibility of a traffic jam.
Sounds fantastic stuff. So from speedy DNA sequencing, James, to speedy batteries. These are batteries that can be charged and presumably discharged much faster than standard batteries.
Exactly. 100 times faster, in fact, than a standard lithium battery that you might have in your current mobile phone or your laptop. These guys at MIT have done a theoretical study to work out what the bottleneck is holding up the transfer of lithium ions from electrode to electrode, which is what's happening where when you're either charging a battery, the flow is one direction. When you're discharging it, it flows in the other direction. And theoretically, that should be pretty quick, but there's some bottleneck holding up this flow. So what these guys have done is they've tweaked the material, the lithium material that the electrode is made of, to speed up that process. They worked out that it's the transfer of the lithium ions between the electrolyte, which is just sort of the medium that the ions flow through, and the electrode itself, which is where the lithium is stored. So as I say, they've sort of tweaked this material. It's a lithium iron phosphate material that they're using. If they adjust the stoichiometry slightly, then what they get is this glassy surface forming. It's poorly crystallized, so there's plenty of space for the lithium ions to travel through, so that improves the lithium ion mobility.
I thought one major problem with lithium batteries was that because the lithium has to adsorb and then desorb from the electrode, like you say, that if you keep doing that, the electrode shatters. So that, again, cuts down the ability of the battery to deliver high current. So is this going to solve that problem?
Well, I don't think they've done any sort of long-term testing on how these materials work. This is just very much in the lab scale and sort of looking at the theoretical aspects and then testing that out to work out exactly what is this the bottleneck that slows these batteries down.
How much better are the batteries going to be that they're anticipating if they were to put their process into practice then?
Well, they're saying that these batteries could be up to 100 times faster to charge and discharge, so you could potentially be charging up your laptop in a couple of minutes rather than having to wait for a couple of hours. And ultimately, the hope is that lithium batteries could be powering electric cars, and then you could charge up the battery as quick as it would be to fill up your car with petrol at the moment. The other thing is, of course, they discharge very quickly, so a lot of power is available for the electric motor in the car, so it could potentially accelerate a lot quicker as well. So you might need smaller batteries and less heavy batteries than you would now.
Powering our way towards better batteries. Thank you, James. And talking of energy sources of the future, just how much power are we actually throwing away? Jeremy Tompkinson from the National Non-Food Crop Centre in York says that there's a better way to deal with much of the rubbish that currently ends up in a landfill.
Finding most attractive at the moment is actually what we call municipal solid waste, which is some of the most difficult things to deal with, and in short it's our filled black bin bags. And it's fairly simple routine stuff where we can take a black bin bag filled with all the kind of stuff that we'd normally put in a bin bag, and we can segregate that into a relatively clean pile of metal, of plastic, of glass, and these things can go down the normal recyclate streams. But when we do this, we always end up with this material that kind of resembles the fluff out the back of your tumble dryer, and it's what we call lignocellulosic. It's basically lignocellulose, i.e. biomass.
And how much of this stuff is there? We're all told that you could fill the International Sports Stadium in Cardiff several times a week with how much we're all throwing away. But how much does this add up to in terms of potential energy?
It's enormous, actually, and we are, as a society, again, I think a lot better now at understanding reusing and recycling and indeed kind of composting materials. But the volume that we throw out is still enormous. I mean, from one small area that we're working out in the northeast at the moment, we're looking at 250,000 to 300,000 tons of black bin bag waste in a year, and that's one small area.
So you take these black bin bags, you sort out what's in them, and you get something which is your raw material, lignocellulosic rubbish.
Correct.
What do you then do with it?
Well, you can do a variety of things with that. You can actually just take it and directly burn it, actually. You can just generate electricity or sometimes heat with that. But we've been fortunate enough just lately to work with a company called Ineos. They are looking at a whole new adoption of basically municipal solid waste and lignocellulosic materials therefrom to generate not just heat, not just power, but also biofuel, all from the same plant. They basically take the material and go through a process that's fairly well established called gasification. This produces a material called syngas. Now, syngas is just a mixture of carbon monoxide and hydrogen, used extensively in the petrochemical industry as what we call a C1 building block. If you think of carbon monoxide just being a single carbon atom with an atom of oxygen, we can use different catalysts, different inorganic and sometimes organic catalysts, to rebuild molecules from this C1 building block. And INEOS have developed a way where we can take syngas that comes from basically lignocellulosic rubbish, clean this so it's a highly clean syngas, and actually it's a living organism that consumes this mixture of carbon monoxide and hydrogen and excretes ethanol as a byproduct. Now, ethanol, as we know, can be used to replace petrol in cars, and as part of the process, it will also produce quite a large amount of electricity, renewable electricity, and heat. So herein we have one process, this is a perfect example, of where we can take the lignocellulosic material from municipal solid waste that otherwise would be quite difficult to use and could, heaven forbid, go into landfill. Now, if it does go into landfill, we are threatened with the possibility it can turn to methane. Methane is, of course, we know 23 times more potent a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. So one kind of no-brainer is we should not be looking at any form of biodegradable material, lignocellulosic material, going to landfill. The key issue is finding a use, and we think we found a superb use for this that basically says converts this through to electricity, heat, and ethanol in one process.
How much energy can we get out of the amount of stuff that we're just throwing away at the moment in the UK, for example?
Well, to put this into some context, the plan that we've got with INEOS at the moment is stopping 150,000 tonnes of black bin bag waste going to landfill. This is then segregated up into the fractions. The lignocellulosic fraction that goes into the plant, well, the plant that will be if we can get the project launched, will produce 30,000 tonnes of ethanol, 10 megawatts of electricity, and an amount of heat that can be used in the plant and actually exported to outside.
Doesn't sound like much, though, Jeremy. 10 megawatts is not a huge amount. I mean, I work in a big hospital and it's probably consuming that.
This is a pilot plant. If the concept is proven, and we've got every reason to think it will be, the next scale, the commercial scale plant from that, will be around 4 to 5 times. So we therefore produce around 150,000 tonnes of ethanol and about 50 megawatts of electricity with the heat.
To move all that recyclate and get it from the people that are producing the rubbish to the factory, the plant itself, that's going to involve a lot of vehicle movements as well. So when you factor in all those other energy sinks, does it still make economic sense?
Indeed it does, because for more pragmatic reasons, it wants to be in areas such as chemical complexes, where we've got blending facilities for the fuel, where we've got good outlets for the heat. And the plan is to basically get the bin lorries to just come and back into the site and empty out. Done from an independent basis, the life cycle analysis shows that we mitigate 98% of the greenhouse gas emissions when we compare that ethanol to petrol. So typically when you drive your car, a petrol car, on average you will emit around 160 grams of carbon dioxide for every kilometre that you travel. Of course here we're less than 5.
Which sounds really quite impressive. But will it work? That was Jeremy Tomkinson, and he's the CEO of the National Non-Food Crop Centre, which is based in York. This is Chemistry World with me, Chris Smith, and still to come, how scientists are using DNA to assemble micro-machines and a new coating that can repair itself when it gets scratched. All that's needed is a short burst of sunshine. But first, Bibi, scientists have laid bare some interesting revelations about the ageing process. So tell us about this.
A group of researchers led by Rochelle Bufenstein at the Bishop Institute in Texas have been studying naked mole rats because there's a very interesting fact about them, and that is that they live for up to 30 years, which is 10 times longer than the average lab mice. So they thought that it would be interesting to do some research on them, and because this research could shed some light on the aging process.
Because these animals can live 10 times longer than equivalent rodent-type animals. How are they doing that?
It's very interesting. They looked at proteins because they are the main target for oxidative damage, which we know is related to aging. And they were looking at the presence of cysteine, which is very sensitive to damage due to the presence of the thiol groups.
And this is the amino acid cysteine, which often forms linkers across proteins with disulfide bridges and things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
So why did they look at that?
Because they were trying to measure the level of oxidative damage, and they were trying to look at the different types of cysteine residues. So they were looking at reversible damage, and how it varied from the mole rats to the lab mice. And surprisingly, they found that the young mole rats had higher levels of cysteine and therefore oxidative damage than mice, but they didn't show any signs of aging. And what is more, when they looked at the naked mole rats, they saw that the protein profile throughout the life of a rat was pretty much the same, which is very interesting. So the only way that they had to tell which were the old individuals and the young ones was because they show less activity, and then their skin was of a different quality. But that was the only visible sign of ageing.
Doesn't this turn on its head our understanding of the ageing process? Because we once thought that you just accumulate damage over the course of a lifetime because of oxidative stress, and that's why we clap out and get wrinkly. And this is saying that isn't the case, isn't it?
Yeah, pretty much. And they are going to be continuing their research because now they need to look at what the processes and the mechanisms for this are. They have discovered that these rats have proteins that are very stable to stress, to oxidative stress. They are very resistant, but they don't know why yet. So they will look at the mechanisms by which this happens.
And hopefully they'll solve that problem in time for when I get old. Thank you very much for that, BP. And let's now look at some interesting crystal structures that have emerged this week, Nina. Tell us about this. This is fascinating.
So this work's been done by Lee Cronin, who's based in Glasgow in the UK, and he's been turning inorganic crystals into micro-sized tubes. So he can grow these tubes into a variety of different sizes and shapes, including he uses some etch-a-sketch type device to create cubes and cross shapes.
What actually are the crystals made of?
They're made of an anionic polyoxymethylate compound. So these crystals are insoluble in water, and they drop them into water, and then they add a polyaromatic cation, which coats the crystals, and water gets absorbed into this coating, and eventually the coating ruptures, and the force of the rupture causes the polyoxymethylate to jet out. This then crystallises, which is the beginning of the tube, and then the polyanions continue to flow down the tube, ensuring that the tube continues to grow.
Why do they actually form tubes? Why not just form one solid blob of crystal materials together? Why do they actually form these straws?
I believe it to do with the force with which the membrane ruptures and the polyoxymethylate comes out of the crystal. I think this is very much similar to the way that lava explodes out of volcanoes.
Oh, it comes up through the middle. So you have a big pool of magma under the volcano and it squirts up the middle and deposits on the outside, and these tubes grow in the sort of same way.
Exactly, Chris.
How do the scientists behind this actually think it can be used, though? What's the point of doing this?
They've suggested two applications so far. So they've shown that you can flow fluid through the tube, so they've been considering them for microfluidic devices. And polyoxymethylate is a well-known catalyst, and they've been doing catalytic reactions within the tubes, but they won't tell us any more about that yet because they're looking to publish it.
I was a big Etch-a-Sketch fan. I'm sure there are some other closet Etch-a-Sketchers out there too. Thank you, Nina. Now, on the subject of designing things, to drawing and modelling, not with an Etch-a-Sketch, but with DNA. Meera Senthilingam spoke to Ned Seaman to find out how he's using DNA to build structures on the nanoscale.
It's really the use of branched, in particular DNA motifs, to make objects and lattices and devices. We use DNA because it has molecular information encoded in it. Well, that same information can be used to direct DNA molecules to interact with other DNA molecules and enable us to make structures and in some ways to make machines.
And so what kind of structures and shapes have you been making?
Over the years, we made things like a DNA cube-like molecule, and a molecule with a topology also of a truncated octahedron that's a 14-sided figure.
But how is this actually done? How are you able to manipulate DNA to make these shapes?
We simply design sequences that will come together to form these things. So when I talk about making a cube, for instance, I'm talking about a stick cube. So the edges correspond to DNA double helices, and the corners correspond to points where DNA branches, where double helices branch from each other. The key aspect of this is that we're using branched DNA, not just linear DNA. Linear DNA is just a one-dimensional species, and if you hook more of a bunch of those pieces together, it's a line and you'll get a longer line. But with branches, and you can start talking about making networks and even more complex things like devices. So the DNA molecule consists of two strands. That's why it's called a double helix. And there's a relationship between the sequence on one strand and the sequence on the other strand. So between the two of them, there's always, if there's a given unit on the left side, there'll be a given unit on the right side. We just use it to ensure who is pairing with whom, and we make synthetic DNA molecules, and the synthetic DNA molecules self-assemble according to these rules so that they form the kind of branch points, and then we connect the branch molecules together in specific orders, and then we can make a whole network or whatever we'd like.
So essentially, you've got these DNA strands, which are then leaving those ends kind of open and available for things to stick onto.
That's right. That's one of the real strengths of DNA, is that we can control the intermolecular interactions of DNA just by having a little tail of unpaired DNA hanging off of some larger construct. Then the DNA will go capture other pieces of DNA that have the complementary tails, and then that allows us to direct the associations of the molecules.
And so you've made these shapes like a cube and an octahedron and things like that, but what can you now do with them?
Okay, so the cube and the octahedron were both training exercises for us. The main things that we're interested in are getting DNA molecules to self-assemble into 2D and 3D lattices. And the goal of these lattices is to assemble either themselves at first, and then to have them act as hosts for macromolecular scale guests. Basically, we're trying to self-assemble crystals. The idea is to make things that will organize other things. When the DNA molecules self-assemble, they take these other things with them to organize them into crystalline arrangements. The original aim here was to try to use well-defined DNA lattices to act as hosts for other biological species, proteins and protein nucleic acid complexes and so forth, things that are found within the cell, in order to work out their three-dimensional structures. Working out three-dimensional structure is done most typically by a procedure known as X-ray crystallography, and this would allow us to observe the interactions of biological systems with potential drugs and so forth, to see how you could stop them from behaving a certain way or force them to behave a certain way or whatever, once you know what they look like. It's a tremendous help to know what something looks like to be able to design therapies and so forth. So growing crystals is hard, though, and the way in which we grow crystals is not, right now it's basically a trial and error method, and we were trying to eliminate that trial and error.
As well as studying things in the cell, there's an electronic application. So what actual applications in electronics could this have?
Well, it would help us to take the components of electronic circuitry and then make them smaller. So that when they're smaller, they're faster, and when they're smaller, they're cheaper, and when they're smaller, they work better. The conventional electronics that we all work with is going to be hitting the wall relatively soon in terms of how small they can make their components. These things are made by basically, you know, lithography, where we work from the top down. And now we're soon going to be hitting an era where we're going to have to work from the bottom up. And that's where this type of control comes in.
So where are you now with this research, and where are you hoping to go next with it?
We've certainly been successful at organizing things in two dimensions. We're working to do that in three dimensions. We're just starting to have our first successes in three dimensions. So the whole goal here is to organize matter in two and three dimensions, not just DNA, which is a great tool. It's a great architectural tool. But its individual properties may or may not be of great utility. So we can use the DNA to organize other things in which we're interested, either cellular components like proteins or other microorganelles, or we can also use it to organize nanoelectronics. And we've made starts on both of those already. You can do all these things in 2D. It's probably more effective to do them in 3D. And we're just getting a handle on 3D now.
DNA, not just the building block of life. It's also potentially the chemist's modelling clay. That was New York University's Ned Seaman talking with Meera Senthilingam. And now, Phil, I hear that scientists are connecting human nose receptors to nanotubes in order to create the ultimate e-nose.
Well, yes, this is some work done by two groups in Korea, led by Professors Park and Zhang from Seoul University. And it's a bioelectronic nose, so it's taking real human smell receptors and building them into a device using a conducting polymer nanotube laid over some electrodes to make the sensor.
How does it actually work? How do you connect a human receptor to a nanotube?
Well, the nanotubes are made from a conducting polymer called polypyrrole, which has carboxylic acid groups hanging off the side of it. And there's also free amine groups on the surface of the protein. So you can make a peptide amide bond between the protein and the nanotube. So it's a true covalent attachment, which gives it a very stable connection to the device and also a very good way of transmitting the signal from when the scent molecule binds to get a good signal through the device.
Let's look at that then. So a smell molecule is added to that receptor. It locks on in the same way as it would in your nose. What happens next?
The binding event at the receptor site causes a change in the charge distribution on the nanotube, which gives an electrical signal through the rest of the device, which they can measure down to concentrations of the molecule of 40 femtomolar, which is really quite impressive.
Why is this better than previously existing e-nose technology? We've had e-noses for a little while. Scientists have been able to sniff various things electronically. Why is this better?
So some of the previous e-nose technologies that are already on the market and being used use solely polymer-based detectors. They don't have the olfactory receptors, the human receptors, so they're very much limited by what they can recognise. You have to build up a very extensive library of how the sensor reacts to different molecules, whereas this is set up to specifically detect one single molecule. The receptor that the Korean group have chosen is very specific to amyl butyrate, which is an ester molecule. It smells of pineapples and apricots, and it's used as a food additive. But if you take very similar esters, such as butyl butyrate or hexyl butyrate, which are only one carbon different either side of the target molecule, then the device gives no response even at concentrations 10 billion times higher than if you're using amyl butyrate.
So they're achieving pretty amazing specificity with this, aren't they? How far away is it then to start saying, well, let's build an artificial human nose, let's have all the receptors, because they've only got 350 or so that enable our noses to work? It doesn't sound too dramatically difficult to put all those receptors onto these nanotubes and have an e-nose that's human.
That's certainly a possibility looking into the future. One of the things that the Korean groups want to do is take varieties of different receptors and make devices like this one to look at how the receptors react to different scent molecules, because not all of our sensors are specific to single molecules. They can react to lots of different molecules, and complex scents are often down to interactions with more than one different receptor. So the next thing that these groups want to do is build devices with different combinations of receptors on, so they can try and probe how we differentiate more complex scents.
Smells good to me. Sounds good too. Thanks, Phil. Now, also, this is a terrific story, James, because for anyone who might be a bit accident-prone with their car, a drive in the sun could put all those nasty dents and scrapes right, perhaps.
Well, not the dents, but definitely the scratches. And yes, as you say, it will just heal themselves in sunlight. So what these guys have done is developed a polyurethane coating that can heal itself. It's a team at the University of Southern Mississippi, and they've taken the basic polyurethane and added a side chain to it, which incorporates an oxetane, which is a small four-membered oxygen-containing ring, which is very reactive, and chitosan, which is derived from chitin, which is a natural material used that crabs use to build their shells, for example. And the derivative, chitosan, is UV-active. What this exploits is the fact that when you have a scratch, you actually get damage down to the molecular level. So these oxetane rings, these reactive rings, get broken in half. When you combine that with the UV activity of the chitosan, what that does is basically breaks into two reactive halves in response to UV. And the chitosan strand reacts with the broken open oxetane ring and basically stitches the scratch together.
How long does it take to mend a bit of damage then?
Well, it can actually be surprisingly quick. The test scratch that these guys inflicted, I don't think it was on one of their cars, but anyway, it was only 10 micrometres thick, but they found that in bright UV light, the scratch was completely stitched back together within 30 minutes.
Bright UV light as in artificially bright, or would this work in the sun?
Well, they say it would definitely work in the sun. It might take a little bit longer than that, and it would probably depend on if it's a sunny day or a cloudy day.
So no hope for this country then. But given that it's based on polyurethane, does that mean it could readily be incorporated into the kinds of paints and coatings we use on cars and various other plastic surfaces right away?
Absolutely. Polyurethane coatings are already applied to things like cars, and they are already pretty tough, scratch-resistant materials. If you scratch it hard enough, then you will scratch the coating. So this sort of active surface takes it to the next step, and those deeper scratches will knit themselves back together.
So no excuse for not keeping your car's paintwork up to scratch in future. Thank you, James, and sorry about the awful pun. Now, James, we are almost out of time, so you better tell us the answer to last month's chemical conundrum.
Well, it was a St Patrick's Day question last month, Chris, and we wanted to know, what is the substance used to remove the sediment from Guinness?
And the answer is isinglass, which is a form of the protein collagen extracted from fish swim bladders. It sticks all of the yeast sediment to its surface and allows it to settle to the bottom of the tank.
Why is it that when people start telling you where the food and drink you loved actually comes from, suddenly it becomes much more unappealing? Thank you, Phil. So, James, what are we looking for next month?
Well, hopefully this is a slightly more appealing question. This is an Easter chocolate-related question. What we're keen to know is, what are the compounds in chocolate, particularly found in dark chocolate, that are believed to give the chocolate its health benefits, particularly reducing the risk of cardiovascular disease? If you want to be in a chance for winning one of our goodie bags, then email your answer to chemistryworld@rsc.org, and don't forget to include your address.
Thank you, James. So if you know the answer, then just as James says, do drop us a line to chemistryworld@rsc.org. And you can also use that same address to send us your thoughts and feedback about this or one of our previous Chemistry World podcasts. Don't forget, there's also our weekly podcast called Chemistry in Its Element, and that's where we take a look at the sinister side of the periodic table. You can tune into Chemistry in Its Element on iTunes or via our website, which is at chemistryworld.org/elements. Chemistry World was brought to you this month by James Mitchell Crowe, Nina Notman, Phil Broadwith and Bibiana Campaseo. The additional production was by Miracintha Lingam, and I'm Chris Smith from thenakedscientist.com. Thanks for listening. Until next time, goodbye.
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.